All right, hope some of you had a chance to go through the exam solutions, and if anything's unclear, please ask me about it in office hours or outside of office hours. I really want you guys to get this toolkit, how to use it, what it means, and then you'll understand life, the universe, and everything. That's our goal. So last time, just to remind you, one thing we derived was imagine an external electric field, which I'm calling E other, being applied to a molecule or an atom. Let's call it a molecule. It induces a dipole moment by rearranging the charges slightly, and in perturbation theory, you can derive a formula for it. If you're talking about the ground state, you can prove this is every term in this infinite sum. Actually, it's an infinite sum and integral over all the quantum states, eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. It's a positive number. So you induce a dipole moment in the same direction as the electric field. And the proportionality constant refers to how easily the charges can be rearranged. So this is the microscopic picture of what happens to a single molecule in an electric field. Now, on the other hand, we have a macroscopic relation. Which we've been talking about so far in the context of Maxwell's equations. The polarization vector, right, in a linear dielectric looks like epsilon naught times the electric susceptibility chi e times the electric field. And so the immediate goal of the next derivation, which leads us to what's called the Clausius-Mossotti equation, an approximate equation, by the way, but it has some real physics in it, real bearing on reality, is to relate these two pictures, the macroscopic picture of what happens in a dielectric medium and the polarizability of the individual molecules in that medium. So in this equation, E is the total macroscopic electric field. And we're going to break this up in this derivation into two contributions in the vicinity of a molecule in the medium. We're going to write it as like the field due to the external field plus the other molecules in the general vicinity of the molecule we're going to focus on. And we'll look at very near the molecule, the field due to itself. Right, after it's polarized, it produces an electric field. It's a dipole, it produces an electric field also. So in this picture, we're going to imagine a spherical volume containing one molecule. And let's give it radius capital R. And let's say it's centered on one molecule. So let's draw a diagram. We'll come over here. Okay, let may a big expanded view of it. At the center of this volume is our one molecule. And this has radius capital R. And basically, the volume of this sphere containing one molecule is 1 over the number density of molecules, of polarizable molecules in the medium. So N is the number density. And if we take 1 over that, then we view this as the volume associated with a single molecule. And I've made the volume of this sphere have that value of the inverse of the density. So this radius R, which is sometimes called the Wigner-Seitz radius, which you obtain by inverting the density, basically, to find a sphere of that radius, and then it's the radius of that sphere. We're going to tackle this situation and try to separate or incorporate and relate this electric field, keep track of the field due to that molecule, averaged over this sphere. Okay, so the first step of this derivation is to average the E field from this dipole, this molecule. We'll average that over the sphere. Okay, there, it's producing, right, some electric field, this dipole. Some direction. We know how to calculate the electric field due to a dipole, and we know how to average it over the volume. We'll just integrate the electric field over that volume and divide by the volume itself. So I'm going to call that E self, that field due to the dipole itself. That's a microscopic field that we know how to calculate, and it'd be 1 over V, the integral of the microscopic electric field, d cubed x. And if you remember, the electric field due to a dipole, it had two important pieces. One part was this funny thing, it involves cosines and sines, and it integrates to zero. But the other part that doesn't integrate to zero, we found was a direct delta function. And that term looked like this. If we are centered at the sphere, the dipole is at the origin, it'd be doing this integral, which is then just the molecular dipole moment divided by 3 epsilon naught V. Okay, so that's the first thing we needed, was to relate that to the dipole moment. Now that's the microscopic relation. Now I can also write that as a polarizability. Remember N times P molecular, that is in fact our polarization vector that we called capital P. Multiply the individual dipole moment times the number of such dipoles per unit volume. So we have a formula for that, which is minus 3 epsilon naught E self. Is one of the important formulas. And now, let's see, I have a bunch of equations I have to keep track of. Right. I'm going to also want this in the other inverted form, E self, in a moment, as minus capital P over 3 epsilon naught. Okay, so the other formulas I need are the macroscopic P epsilon naught chi E times total electric field, which I'm going to rewrite as this sum of the other contributions to the field plus E self. Right, so I'm going to call that equation star, and now I'm going to equate that to this form of P here that I've circled, which maybe I will call equation double star if you want for reference. Now we have one other key equation. Is it already written here? This one. Right. Which is P molecule is epsilon naught gamma molecule E other, and E self is minus a third gamma molecule N E other. Okay, let me make sure I've got all this right. The other equation I'm missing. This derivation is a little tricky, and I always get myself a little confused. Right. So now the point is to plug in. Everywhere I have E self, I'm going to plug in this equation. Then you'll see every term in the equation is proportional to E other. And I can factor that out of the equation. And then I'll have my relation between gamma and chi, which is the goal of this derivation. Relating the microscopic and the macroscopic pictures. So taking that and dropping the E other, we get epsilon naught chi E, 1 minus a third, the polarizability times the density must equal minus 3 epsilon naught times minus a third polarizability times the density. And now I can solve that for chi e. Then that's gamma polarizability times density over 1 minus a third polarizability times density. That's one form of the Clausius-Mossadi equations. Another form we sometimes have is remembering for this linear dielectric, D is epsilon E, which is polarization vector plus epsilon naught E, which is epsilon naught chi E plus epsilon naught E. So that, remember, chi is epsilon minus epsilon naught over epsilon naught. And so we can solve this equation for gamma, the polarizability, and relate that to the dielectric constant, which is the traditional form of the Clausius-Mossadi equation. I'll spare you that algebra, but you can do that yourself. It'll be 3 over the density of the molecules, the number density, and then times epsilon over epsilon naught minus 1 divided by epsilon over epsilon naught plus 2. And this is what we call the Clausius-Mossadi equation. Okay, so that was the point of that derivation. And obviously it's using rather crude ideas in a sense of kind of pretending we can break up a volume into a bunch of little spheres. And so it's to be taken a little bit with a grain of salt, but in fact, it's a pretty decent approximation for dilute gases. And if you apply it, though, to, say, liquid or solid condensed matter situations, it gives kind of the right order of magnitude, sort of solids maybe have epsilon over epsilon naught. Might be of order 1 to 10 in condensed matter situations. And it gives roughly that. If you take, so I had some estimate somewhere. Maybe I'm doing that later. Sorry, a little disorganized today. Okay, maybe that's all I wanted to say, mainly get this equation. But now I wanted to do another really crude microscopic model of polarizability, the type of thing people would do before they really knew quantum mechanics. So imagine yourself around the turn of the century, 1900, we're starting to understand there are electrons and protons in these media, and that's making up the matter. So what could we do to make a model? Okay. So basically, we could think, first of all, of the origins of macroscopic polarization. It really has two possible mechanisms. The first is E other, you have an electric field. It's going to be applied to a chunk of matter. It's going to rearrange the charges slightly, as we've already seen. And induces electric dipoles through their polarizability. That's what we've just been talking about, this effect. There's another way you can see polarization occur macroscopically. Seems quite different, but you can work it out. You could imagine, especially in a gaseous situation, having a gas of like polar molecules, which have an intrinsic electric dipole moment built into them, like sodium chloride, for instance. And let's say they have an intrinsic dipole moment, P naught. Every molecule has this permanent dipole. It's always there in a gas. But if you just have a gas with no electric field present, the dipoles, of course, are kind of pointing randomly, and they will, on average, cancel themselves out and have no net polarization macroscopically. And so the average dipole would be zero in that situation. But when you apply an electric field, this will give the molecules an incentive to line up a little bit, at least on average. They will be fighting this random tendency to be pointing against this fact that their energy will be a little lower if they line up with the field. And now you can get the mean dipole moment not zero. And I want to do a kind of a model of these two scenarios. The second we can treat pretty quantitatively, but let me start with the first. And we have to make a kind of crude model of the type people were making in those early days. So for case one, the induced moments, let's have the following model. Okay, so you've learned some of the rules of theoretical physics. There is, when in doubt, number one, integrate by parts. Number two, what was number two? Sorry? Ah, yeah, do a binomial or Taylor expansion. Third is, when making a model and having no other ideas, try a harmonic oscillator. So that's what we'll try here. So in other words, we're going to imagine that an electron is bound in a molecule by a harmonic oscillator restoring force. Something like m omega naught squared x with some characteristic frequency governing the strength of this oscillator. M is the electron mass. And when we apply in an external field E naught, right, the oscillator will stretch the spring until it equals the electric force. So we'll balance the forces. QE naught is equal to M omega naught squared X. And then we can calculate, so there's a distortion X, right, which is linear in the field. And we can calculate the dipole moment as QX, and then equate that to Q squared over M omega naught squared E naught, which would say in this model that since the polarizability we've also said is epsilon naught gamma E naught, right? We have a model relating the polarizability to M omega squared in this harmonic oscillator model. So we can check the order of magnitude of that because we know what are the frequencies of electronic excitations in typical matter. See if this makes any sense, right? So in a typical gas of molecules, we might set H bar omega naught to be an energy of around 4 electron volts. Went through these numbers in the notes. And then if we multiply that by the charge on a electron and keep track of that and H bar, we get that omega naught would be something like 6 times 10 to the 15 radians per second for our oscillator frequency. And those numbers work out, if I plug them in, I've done that in the notes, gives some number like 8.6 10 to the minus 29 meters cubed. Jackson goes through a similar calculation and gets one order of magnitude smaller. I suspect there's a numerical error in his calculation, page 163. But if we turn this into a radius, like by taking, remember gamma has dimensions of a volume. We take gamma over 4/3 pi to the 1/3. This would be something like the radius attached to one molecule, or the size. This would give something like 5 angstroms, which is the right order of magnitude. That kind of makes sense to interpret that as a molecular volume. Some other numbers. Oh yeah, here's where I give the estimates from Clausius Mossadi, just to kind of see that the numbers are not crazy. That if we use a density like 2.5 times 10 to the 25 molecules per cubic meter, at normal temperature and pressure, right, 20 degrees Celsius, 1 atmosphere, then chi e, in that case, would be of the order of n density times the molecular polarizability, and this would work out to be 0.0022 from the Clausius-Mossadi equation, meaning that epsilon over epsilon naught for such a gas would be about 1.0022. And if you look at experiment for air, this epsilon over epsilon naught at those conditions, 20 degrees Celsius, 1 atmosphere, it's like 1.00054. So a right order of magnitude off by a factor of 4 kind of gives the right rough idea. But on the other hand, if you look at the densities in a solid, let's say, or liquid, the density would be more like 10 to the 28 or 10 to the 29 per meter cubed, leads to chi of the order of 1 to 10, as I mentioned earlier. And that is roughly the right order of magnitude for condensed matter, but you can't take it too much more seriously than that, these rough models. At least they kind of give some sense that we understand the basic physics, but I mean, really, of course, the quantum mechanics of a real solid is a very hard job and far beyond the scope of this course. Okay, so let's go to mechanism 2, which we can treat in a quite different way and really pretty accurately. So again, mechanism 2 is we're going to look at orienting permanent moments. Okay, pick your favorite polar molecule, make a gas of it, and apply a field to it. Okay. So let's start with the, basically we'll do this with classical statistical mechanics. All right, so we have in a field E naught, the energy of one permanent dipole moment. All right, in Hamiltonian language, will be the unperturbed field-free Hamiltonian minus the dipole dotted into E naught. That's the energy of a permanent dipole moment in an external electric field. Don't forget that this is not the right formula if it's an induced dipole moment. If P naught is proportional to the E field, then you have to divide this by 2. We'll see that derived later. So basically, in stat mech, the different configurations occur with a probability. Given by the Boltzmann factor. Call it F of H is e to the minus H over KT. And so we can do the average dipole moment using that that probability. Let's assume the field is applied in the z-axis, so we're going to calculate the mean value of the z component of the dipole, and this will be integral minus 1 to 1 d of cos theta p naught cos theta times e to the negative of this term, which is e to the p naught e naught cos theta over kt. Probably a lot of you have seen this in your this derivation in your undergraduate StatMet class. And then we have to divide by. The normalization p naught e naught cos theta over kt. And these are simple integrals. I'll spare you that trouble. Just write down the answer. That works out to be minus kt divided by the magnitude of the electric field plus p naught hyperbolic cotangent of p naught e naught over kt. And in the limit that the dipole energy p naught e naught is very tiny, much less than kt, this goes to known limit 1/3 p naught squared e naught over kt. So it does become, it is linear in the weak field limit and it's consistent kind of with our understanding of linear response of the polarizability to the field in weak field limits. And there's a figure in Jackson you might look at showing that. Okay, that's I think all I wanted to say about relating microscopic and macroscopic ideas of polarization in different types of media. So that you can see it involves some subtle arguments. I find this subject a little bit tricky, how to talk about it qualitatively, but one of the main takeaways is that there are regimes where you do see linear behavior with respect to field. Now, we move to another somewhat subtle topic, which is a little tricky, I think, is how to think about electrostatic energy in the presence of dielectrics. So one of the things that you probably learned as an undergraduate is that if you have a capacitor, right, connected to a battery at some voltage V, it can store much more energy if there's a dielectric between the capacitor plates. And basically, the capacitance gets enhanced by the dielectric constant compared to its value with just a vacuum between the capacitor plates, where kappa is epsilon over epsilon naught. That's what we call the dielectric constant. It's normally most materials greater than one. So the energy we've seen before is 1/2 CV squared of the capacitor charged up to voltage V, right? So that will be half kappa C naught V squared. It'll be larger than the energy without the dielectric. Okay. So what I'd like to do now is derive this result and make it a more general statement about energy and dielectrics. And we have to be real careful. Like always with energy discussions, we have to be careful about our signs. We have to be careful about what is doing the work and so on. Okay. So let's start starting point. Is what we know already, the primitive definition for the energy of a charge distribution rho that is in free space. So what we found was that W would be a half the volume integral of the charge distribution multiplied at each point by the electrostatic potential at that point, volume integral, and over all free space, which would be a convergent integral if there are no point charges. Point charges would lead to divergences, which we're not interested in. So imagine all the charges are smeared out in some volume sense like that, giving convergent integrals. And rho, this is the same charge distribution that produces phi. So we saw back, I think that was in chapter one, that I think that was derived. You might review that if it's a little rusty. But now when we're in this more complicated scenario with dielectrics, it's maybe not so obvious just at the start. Is rho the free charge, is it the total charge, including bound charges? We have to think that through. Or do you think it's obvious? We don't have to think. Let's think. Okay, let's think. Okay, so here is kind of how we want to approach this, and this kind of strategy is used a lot in energy discussions. So here is what I'll call the careful discussion. See if you buy it. We want to consider a tiny change in energy, infinitesimal change, delta W, to some existing amount of energy, W, that is caused if you bring in an additional free charge, let's say from infinity, delta rho. I'll call it delta rho free. Jackson just calls it delta rho, but that's what he means when he writes delta rho, is bringing in some extra free charge density from infinity. And we want to determine this new W plus delta W as rho free goes from rho free to rho free plus delta rho free. So the claim is that this delta W is going to be delta rho free times the original phi of x. Integrated over volume. Right, so we have some rho free, and in that region there's some phi of x, and now we have some little tiny bit delta rho free we're going to bring in and make it infinitesimally more charge. So now what we know is that del dot D from Maxwell's equations is rho free. And so del dot delta D will be delta rho free. And so I can rewrite this delta W integral as the integral of phi times del dot delta d, d cubed x. And now I'm going to use the identity. When you see a divergence in an integral like this, it's often interesting to rewrite the integrand as the divergence of something. That can be done with this identity, del dot delta d phi, right, is del dot the quantity phi delta d minus del phi dot delta D. So I'm going to insert this in the integral, and now I have two integrals, one of which is a divergence integral I can convert to a surface integral. Of phi delta D dotted into the normal integral of the area. This integral will soon go to zero if the surface goes off to infinity. So we'll be neglecting this term. And then the other term is minus del phi dot delta d, but that's plus the volume integral of e dot delta d, d cubed x, volume integral, essentially over all space. So this is the main result, that this change of energy, as you go from rho to delta, rho free plus delta rho free, changes the energy by this amount. This is a quite general formula, generally true. So in a sense, that's the most fundamental result from our derivation. We haven't assumed a linear dielectric. We have not made many assumptions at all. Another way of writing then the total energy is to integrate both sides of that equation. from 0 up to the final D. So I'll write this way, a volume integral of now the integral 0 to D of E dot delta D. And I just should point out that this integral in a complex material might be path dependent on how you actually did this. For instance, there could be hysteresis. Okay, but you can imagine things will be quite a bit simpler if we go to the limit of a linear dielectric. That's the more common scenario. So let's see how things simplify in that case. Is that okay? Or do you just want to leave it there? Are you hungry?
Yeah.
You want to do this or not?
Yeah.
Okay. I feel the energy rising. So, linear. Wow. This better be sweet. So if we have a linear dielectric medium, right, E is proportional to D. D and E are proportional. So in particular, delta D is epsilon delta E. And then we get a simpler expression because E dot delta D is simply a half delta of E dot D. And so delta W is just delta of one half the integral of E dot D, D cubed x. And if we build it up by doing the integral, we get the macroscopic energy to be simply one half the integral of E dot D over the whole volume. So that's the nicest formula, but don't forget it's only valid for linear media. Do you believe it? Sort of. Okay, another calculation we might be interested in is, let's look at the change in energy if you've got an electric field applied and you place a dielectric, a chunk of dielectric into the area where there is this electric field present, produced by some other fixed sources of field. Okay, so let's set up the scenario. Okay, so imagine the field E naught of X is produced by some distant charges. I guess they aren't necessarily so distant. Rho naught. And let's say that it's originally in some medium with dielectric constant epsilon naught of X. And let's assume that it's not necessarily vacuum, just to make it more general. And so then we draw a picture of that scenario before we bring in a chunk of other dielectric material. Okay, so we've got some volume. There are some charges in the universe, rho naught. Maybe there, maybe here, more charges. And we have some medium of dielectric constant epsilon naught. Then it has some initial energy. Assume this is a linear dielectric. So it has some initial energy W naught, which we've just seen would be 1/2 the integral of the E field dotted into the D field, integrate over this volume. And so now we're going to have a volume V1 of some different dielectric constant. I think I called it epsilon 1. Yeah. Epsilon 1, some volume V1. And I'm going to pull it in from outside into this medium somewhere. So now we have this situation. So you can sort of think schematically that a graph of epsilon x as you go from inside that material to outside, it'll kind of look something like that, going from epsilon 1 to epsilon naught, and this representing the edge of this volume in subdirection that we're going from, say, inside the V1 to out to outside of it, where it's epsilon naught. Okay. So our new energy will be, I'll call it W1, be 1/2 the integral of E dot D. And D, of course, is epsilon E. And so let's find the energy change in the system from bringing that in. That will be the new energy minus the old energy, which which is a half integral of E dot D minus E naught dot D naught D cubed X, which we can rewrite as a half E dot D naught minus D dot E naught D cubed X plus a half integral of E plus E naught. You'll see the point of this in a second, dotted into D minus D naught D cubed X. Right. Now let's analyze just this second integral. This can also be written as minus a half the integral of the gradient of phi plus phi naught dotted into d minus d naught d cubed x. And now the first theorem of theoretical physics will be invoked. Integrate by parts. And again, we'll assume the surface terms vanish because we went to infinity. Then this looks like a half phi plus phi naught del dot d minus d naught d cubed x. And the point, now you probably see the point of doing this, because there's no free charges here, or there was no change in the free charges, and so this integral is zero. We didn't bring in extra free charge, we just brought in this charge-free dielectric chunk. So we have a new formula for delta W. Which is the interesting quantity here. Will be the 1/2 again, integral over the whole system. Let's just call it all space. E dot D naught minus D dot E naught. E cubed X. Now, because the outside of this chunk, this integrand is zero. So in the end, this is actually only integrating over V1. So I can also just rewrite this volume integral as the integral over V1, which means I can also, for a linear dielectric, write it as 1/2 the V1 integral of epsilon 1 minus epsilon naught E dot E naught D cubed X. And now if we go and suppose the original situation was vacuum dielectric, then if it was free space, right, then we have epsilon 1 minus epsilon naught E is also epsilon naught chi E times E, and that's just our polarization vector P. So back here. We have another somewhat simpler to interpret formula. That delta W is just minus a half the volume integral over this new chunk of dielectric of the polarization density dotted into the original electric field, d cubed x. And this leads us to, we can interpret this formula as saying a dielectric placed into an E field, external E field, has an energy density per unit volume, little w is minus a half polarization density dotted into the field, electric field. And so the main point is not only this energy density, but also the sign matters, right? Because P will typically be in the same direction as E naught in a linear dielectric. And so the energy is lowered by bringing in this material with a higher dielectric constant. So if you, you know, have the capacitor with voltage V, and you bring in a chunk of dielectric, it's going to be pulled in. Its energy is lowered by having it go in. It's going to be attracted. And don't lose sight of the fact that the energy of permanent dipoles in a field is different than energy of induced dipoles in a field. You have to keep track of this extra one half. Right? If you had a material, brought in a material with a constant polarization, like a barelectrode, into the material, its energy would be, for permanent polarization, call it P naught, right? Its energy density would equal simply minus P naught dot E naught. So that's the difference. This logic also applies to a single molecule. That its energy in a field is different if the dipole is induced versus permanent. Right. So for a single atom or molecule, you might be saying to yourselves, wait a second, atoms don't have permanent dipole moments. But actually, some atomic states do have permanent dipole moments, like N equals 2 of hydrogen. 2s and 2p in degenerate perturbation theory can form these combinations that really are not spherically symmetric and really have permanent dipole moments. Whenever you have degenerate states of opposite parity, you can make a dipole. So anyway, usually we're talking about molecules, though. But there are special cases where an atom will behave like it has a permanent dipole moment. So anyway, coming to the energy of an individual molecule, right, we've already seen that its energy is the dipole moment dotted into the external electric field. If it's permanent, K permanent. But if it is induced, it's minus 1/2 P of E dotted into E which since right basically as P goes it's as you add a tiny amount of electric field delta E right you get its induced dipole moment based on the polarizability times delta E and so W is minus 1/2 epsilon naught times the polarizability times E squared. If it's an induced dipole moment proportional to the field. Okay, so permanent and induced. Again, at the individual molecule level, there is this factor of two difference. That's important not to lose sight of, lose track of. Okay, is that clock accurate? Yeah, I think so. And I think instead of starting chapter 5 now, I think we'll stop for the day. Those are some heavy derivations, I know. It involves some thinking. It's always scary. But we did some thinking, tried to piece our way through it. And now we can get on with our lives and solve homework problems instead. See you on Tuesday.